You're listening to Little Green Cheese, episode 103. Well, welcome back, Herd Nerds. This is Little Green Cheese Podcast. I'm Gavin Weber, and today we have an interview with Dan Leeton. Now, Dan comes from the UK, and this interview was taken from the 6 Hours of Cheese Extravaganza live stream. And Dan talks about interesting things about unusual cheeses, cheeses that have gone extinct, and cheeses that he makes at medieval reenactment days that he participates in. Very interesting interview. Allow me to introduce Dan Leeton. So, Dan, wonderful to have you in the live stream, the 6 Hours of Cheese today. Introduce yourself, mate.
Okay, so I'm in Cambridge in the UK. Actually, today I'm not. I'm at a friend's, actually, funnily enough. But I'm Cambridge, UK, and I kind of do technology stuff most of the time. I'm a product developer. But weirdly enough, I've been applying that to cheese making and some other things as well recently. So
nice.
What I do. And I do some interesting hobbies, but we may come to that.
I think we will. So what, and that leads me to my next question is why did you start making cheese?
So I kind of started making cheese a very long time ago, you know, like vinegar cheeses and ricottas and that kind of thing. Decades ago, because we do this historical reenactment hobby. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
And actually, it's quite a nice thing to demonstrate to people. Okay. And you get something you can eat, which is always a good start. Really, though, I started making proper rennet cheeses only really the last year. The last 6 months or so, something like that, maybe a little longer, not that long, but I learned quick. So I've been doing interesting things. And I started making cheese because the cheeses I wanted to eat aren't made in Europe, weirdly.
Right.
We get everything except a couple of really specific cheeses. Specifically, there's a Georgian cheese, which I love, which we can talk about, and you just can't get it. So that's one of the key reasons why I started is I can get great cheddar. I can get great Stilton. Gorgonzola, Chèvre, raw milk, pasteurized milk, stinking of old socks, doesn't matter. You can get it because we're in the UK. Fine. But I couldn't get the two or three things I really wanted. And I also couldn't get some cheese which is no longer made. It's extinct.
So, that's very interesting. Now, these extinct cheeses, now there are a couple, and I've got some pictures, I'm pretty sure. Let me see if I can bring those up. 2 seconds, if my brain works.
I haven't tried to label them nicely for you because I'm.
Yes, you did. So here we go. Now, can you still hear me?
Yes, mate.
All right, good.
I can't see what you can see. I can only see you. So hang on a second.
So the cheese that we, if you look at the live stream, you should be.
I'll just mute the site and then I'll just put up. Put up Gavin.
All right, now there was some. There we go. So what I've done here, I've brought up the Cambridge cheese.
No, that's not the Cambridge cheese, mate. That's my very first attempt at a Georgian cheese.
Oh, hang on. Well, it says here on the label. It says on the label Cambridge.
Is it? Oh, I lied. I mislabeled it. You want the one that's kind of on orange stripe, made with a natto.
That
in
one.
The middle of it.
That one.
Well, I can't see. Yet, but
all right, so
no, that one says Imeretian. The one we need is the one that says, hang on, let me just see. Not that one.
Yeah,
keep going. It is that one, but you need the one after it. Yeah, that's the beginning of the Cambridge cheese,
right? So,
a couple photos down if you want to see it looking pretty.
Okay, do I want it pretty? No, that's
yeah, you
that's,
do. Yeah.
There we go. Yeah, there it is.
And the next one,
it's got that tomatoes. There we go. There's a little bit of a delay, I think.
Yeah, I think there is. The one with tomatoes is the one you want. That's it.
That's the one.
There you go. Yeah.
So this is a Cambridge cheese. And tell me about this. Why? Do you know any idea why it went extinct?
Yeah, I do. I mean, so there's two reasons. There's two cheeses I'm making: Cambridge cheese and Cottenham cheese. And Cottenham cheese is a village just outside Cambridge, right?
Yep.
These are both really, really famous cheeses back in, well, from the sort of 18th century up to, well, the end of the, well, sorry, 17th century up to the end of the 19th century into the 20th century. What happened with the Cambridge cheese has got hit by war efficiencies. So right. Basically, there were thousands of cheeses in England. So, well, I say England, let's say the British Isles. 2,000 odd cheeses were known about, right? Mm. And those 2,000 cheeses ended up being sort of chopped down to just a few for the purposes of war efficiencies. And things like cheddar and red Leicester and Cheshire and manufactured carefully and all of these became much easier to produce large in large volumes. So the Ministry of Agriculture and the war effort just kind of said, yeah, we want these. So that's what happened. So Cambridge cheese stopped being made in bulk then. And then it did kind of carry on afterwards until about the 1960s or thereabouts as one dairy. And then all the dairies were taken over and agglomerated into big monopolies.
Yeah.
Or not monopolies, but big sort of, massive dairies. And the last one that was making it, which was an independent Cambridge dairy, became part of United Dairies, and they just stopped making it. And it was a fresh cheese, so it had to be made very, very regular because it lasts maximum 2 weeks, the Cambridge cheese. But it used to be really, really famous. When you look at some of the 18th century cartoons, you see there's sort of one. There's one actually. I sent it to you a while ago. I forgot to send it to you.
Yeah.
And it's got piles of cheese in the background. One of the cheeses is a Cambridge cheese, and the others are Cottenham cheese.
Wow.
And then there's only four or five others. And the four others are Stilton and, a couple of others of Derbyshire or something like that. So this cheese was famous, and it was one of Pepys's favourite cheeses. You see it in lots of the records. And it's like a kind of lactic cream cheese, very lactic cream cheese, almost like a cottage cheese flavor, but it's not at all rubbery. It's spreadable, slight grain to it. It's not pressed at all. You just put the curds in, you ladle them out, you put them in, presses under its own weight, and turns into this lactic sort of flavor cheese. It's fantastic with honey. It's amazing with tomatoes and cucumber. It's like a kind of grown-up version of a cream cheese, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So that's the Cambridge.
The yellow line in the middle? Is that just one of the features of the cheese?
Okay, weirdly, I do know the answer to this because since I last spoke to you, so I did a lot of work up. I actually went to the historical archives. I went up there, I sat in the archives, and then I went to speak to an old friend of ours. I tried to go to speak to an old friend of ours who unfortunately has died. And she was the last person who made Cambridge cheese since the 60s. And I think a few other people have done it. But what actually happened is the Cambridge cheese was actually a variation of a milk cheese or possibly a cream cheese, also a cheese called York cheese, same thing. And what happened is a rather awkward guy up in the Fens near Cambridge was making it and had loads of run-ins and legal disputes with the local legal sort of people about what type of cheese this is. And he got so fed up of it not being able to call it cream cheese. He apparently was the guy who ended up calling it Cambridge cheese. And he stuck a line through it to show that it was different.
Right.
And that's all it is to show that it's different from York cheese, which is identical, but doesn't have a line in it.
There you go. And the flavor wouldn't have changed because it's just an Arto anyway. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah. It makes no difference. Looks good, though,
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Now, the other cheese was that went extinct was Cottenham, you mentioned. We've got here. Yeah, so we've got that. Hang on, I'll bring up a picture of that.
Go ahead.
There we go. So it's like a little blue cheese.
Well, the one I'm doing right now is a little blue cheese, right?
Right.
Because I haven't made a big one. But originally, it's massive, right? It's so if you imagine your Stilton is, my big lad, so it's still like about that, right?
Yeah.
So the Cottenham cheese was about that broad, so 18 inches across and about 9 inches, 10, something like that sort of tall. So very broad, very, very deep, very sort of massive cheese, like almost like a wheel of, you know, Emmental or something like that. Maybe
right. Yep.
That.
Yep.
I think when they made them in batches, they were making them out of 12 gallons or something like that. So whatever the hell that is, 40, 50 liters.
Yeah.
And that's a one cheese, right? So big old cheese, you know, it comes down to about, I think about 12 kilo, 10 kilo cheese.
Massive.
Big enough. You
know, yeah.
Pretty big. Yeah. And they were made up till the end of the 19th century regularly. And then, and this is another thing I was sitting up in the archives reading, I was reading through the minutes of the Cattle Plague Committee of the Cambridgeshire region.
Right.
To see if I could see any mention of cheese. And the answer is no. I just saw a lot of talk about dead cows.
Right.
And the basically what happened is cattle plague wiped out the dairy industry pretty well around the Cambridgeshire region. In sort of lower Cambridgeshire, which is where Cambridge is. And that really killed the industry. And there's one, as far as we know, there are three copies of a recipe, one of which is useless because there's just not enough in it. It just says the milk's basically the thing that's important. So what we know is that the milk, the cows are grazed on the fen edges where there's a lot of wild thyme. And right. This was seen as, this is the flavor that's in the milk, is wild thyme after it's been digested by these cows, and apparently it's a fantastic flavor cheese, milk, sorry. So then, and then basically, the other thing about Cottenham, which is where it was primarily made, and also Waterbeach and Denny Abbey, which is just nearby, they're all in the fens, on the edge of the fens, they get flooded all the time. In fact, so much so that people had, you know, standing water in their houses on a regular occasion for a different year.
That's shocking.
Okay. Yeah, well, sort of, yeah. I mean, you know, but out of that came this amazing cheese, because the cheese houses, and there's still two or three left in Cottenham, and you know where they are because they're attached to these houses. They used to have water at the bottom of them. Now that's a lovely humid environment.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Humidified cheese. And there were actually two types. There's a blue type and a white type. And my hunch is that the blue type was what turned up in the humid years.
Yeah.
And the white type is what turned up when the humidity was not high enough to help the penicillium.
Yeah,
because apparently what happened is somebody stole the recipe, or at least recreated the recipe from early Stilton cheese, which probably got its penicillium rock 40i from somewhere else anyway.
Yeah.
So that's the hunch. But the recipe, so we've got two extant recipes, one of which is owned by a family of a vicar who's died, and he was the last person who ate Cambridge cheese was still alive. Right. He's definitely, because this was 1960s, 70s. He might have some relatives who might still have this recipe. I'm trying to get hold of it. The other one was held and given to this old friend of mine who sadly died. And when I went round just the other week after I spoke to you last, and I saw Bob Gale, who's her husband, and he took me round Ellie's old dairy. And he showed me the original, and the original was of the lady called Elizabeth Chivers, and there's a very famous jam factory, a jam company in Cambridgeshire called Chivers Jam, and she made Cottenham cheese, and
right.
The recipe was gathered from her when she was in her 90s, in the 1980s, very early 1980s or late 70s, by Ellie, and I've got the piece of paper.
You've got the recipe.
That's well, crazy. The recipe is sitting there on this board in you know, Ellie's old dairy, which Bob looked after. And I look at this and go, there's copies of this all over the place. You've got the original sitting there in a board in a slightly damp sort of room. And I'm going to sort of go to him at some point and say, would you like me to take this up to the archive and put it with the original? Because it's the only sort of relatively extant recipe.
It's a piece of history. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. But I use that to make my recipe.
Oh, nice.
It's not complete. It's not complete. It's missing a lot of stuff. It's kind of, you know, that thing with cheese, you know, cheesemakers, when they're making it every day, they're not necessarily.
They're not telling you everything in the recipe.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily that. I just don't think they're necessarily thinking about it, because part of it is it's very humid in this place. Therefore, the cheese turns out the way it turns out.
Yeah.
You know, we sew it up in calico in this way because that's just the way we've done it. But when do you sew it up? You know, and when's it ready? Christmas. Well, we don't even know when the recipe is.
When was it started?
well, here's the thing. I think it's probably because there were another cheese in Cotton called an Eddish cheese. So a cheese that was a flat 12-inch by 1-inch sort of soft cheese, a bit like a camembert. And that was made on the Edish grass, which is the hay that grows in after the first hay crop. And that's an autumn milk.
Right.
So my hunch is that the blue cheeses were made on the summer milk, which is why she was saying you need 90 days or so to at least to mature. So 90 days around Christmas, well, we're back at the end of summer.
Yeah.
And the Edish cheese is what you're going to get in the autumn. So that's my hunch, is that what she was at, was actually collected in the summer. And she was talking about, you know, well, if you made it now, it'd be ready in time for Christmas, which would be about 90 days after the end of summer, when the summer milk ends. That's my hunch.
Right. So summer in the UK, not Australia, obviously.
Yeah.
I was getting confused there because my seasons are a little bit different.
I thought it was just like you know, 900 degrees every day in Australia, isn't that right?
Oh, at least. Yeah. That's why we've all got tans, see?
That's right. Yeah, you're wearing your sun kit,
yeah,
you know.
Not. Anyway, well, so was there any other pictures of cotton? Let me just have a look. Oh, yeah, here we go.
Yeah, you
they're wrapped in the cave. Let's have a look.
Yeah.
That one. Right. So in a cheese cave, you've got the two blue cheeses wrapped in cloth. Is that like a calico, like you mentioned?
It's just a piece of cheesecloth, so I used your recommendation for your last Stilton video.
Right, yes.
Where you were talking about wrapping them with some oxygen to be able to get them. So I'm trying this first one, you know, to make sure there's enough blue penetration.
Yeah.
And then I'll try a tight wrap version at some point, but I wanted to see what happens if we don't wrap it yet. But wrapped it enough that we're trying to stop too much of the blue grain on the outside. I want it to go into the cheese.
Yes.
Which I believe is the whole idea. And you can see one of those pictures. There's a little bit of dye off on the outside where I haven't quite wrapped it properly, but, you know, it's okay. A little bit of smell of old socks there. So I think there's probably a bit of Brevi bacteria hanging around on the outside there.
Yeah, I can see that on that photo there, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's what it is. It smells a little bit of old socks, and there's a little bit of an ammonia tang coming off of it.
Yeah, that's normal.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, and they smell nice, and they look okay. There's no black mold, no pink mold. There's no sort of weird stuff. I do a little bit of a brush every now and again if I see something which looks a bit sort of like a little spotty colony. But basically, one of them's one set of cultures, and the other one's a different set of cultures.
Oh, okay. So yeah,
one that's more that looks more, should we say, mature, is a farmhouse cheese culture. That's where they made 4000 culture in there, and the other one, and the other one, of course, I'm behind on. Yeah, there you go. And the other one is, I think, a Flora Danica culture, if I remember. I'd have to look at my notes, but it's an aromatic culture. I went, you know, I'll try it. I want to see. You know, because what I'm after with this is that the flavor was supposed to be a creamier, milder, Stilton-like flavor. So I'm going, well, why don't I start heading towards more of a kind of Gorgonzola Dolce sort of style? Something more aromatic, something more creamy.
More buttery in the mouth.
Yeah, a little more buttery and see what happens. It's developing much slower, that right-hand one, than the other one, for reasons not entirely clear to me. These were made super scrupulously the same. I mean, really, kind of quite particular about it because I'm a scientist. I want it to be a good experiment, you know. So they're in the identical thing. They're exact same humidity, everything. That's the only real difference between them, and we'll find out. You know, we'll find out which one's working. You know,
I have one question, and that is, what are the cables going into the cheese fridge?
That's the humidifier and the temperature probe.
Oh, okay. So they're behind the cheeses, is it?
If you look at that picture, you'll see there's three little cables. There's a cable underneath each bit, and they're literally right in between them. Partly because I wanted to know which of my three very cheap humidifier and temperature cables were accurate or not. And two of them read the same, give or take a percent point. One of them is like 2 or 3 degrees out and about 10 degrees out on the humidity, and they're literally next door to each other. So that humidity detector is going to get thrown because it's just off.
Yeah. Now, I've brought up a photo of two of the displays that you have. Now, you said that you had some cheap displays, but like, did you get them off Amazon or something like that?
So yeah, the displays are basically Amazon. £9. I don't know how much that is. That's $11-12 US for three humidifier temperature things. That's what's in there. You can see the probe in the middle there, right? So they're just really cheap. You know, and they show temperature, humidity, and you can see that they're sort of, you know, pretty close to each other. You know, good enough for this.
And there was another one, this one here. This is the one you plug in. This is the how you control the fridge, right?
Yeah, so that's the cheese temperature. That's the temperature of the fridge. So basically, again, I think about £15, so about just under $20 from Amazon. It has a temperature probe. You set the temperature you want the fridge to go on and off.
Yep.
And it runs, and when it's 13 degrees, it turns it on. And when it drops to 11 degrees, it turns it off. And literally, that's it. And it cost me £20. And the fridge was free from a local sort of business that was giving it away on Gumtree.
Yep.
So you know, I got I've got a cheese cave with humidity and temperature control for, you know, less than $30, which I makes me very happy.
Excellent.
Yeah. The other thing that I found interesting. So originally I had the fridge out in the garage, but it's about 5 degrees here right now. So what is that? Well, I mean, it was about 32, going down to even 23 or something in Fahrenheit. You know, it was getting sub-zero, and that's no good for the cheese. And the cheese, the fridge doesn't heat up, so I had to get another one and bring it inside, so that
it was just getting too cool.
It was far too cool. Way too cool. So basically, I had to move the fridge inside because I don't have a heated garage, because 1930s house in the UK. This doesn't. It's not a thing. apart from that, nice and cheap and recycled, you know. It's always good to use recycled stuff, you know. The only terrible thing about that fridge is it's got two labels from the company on the front, one of which says it's number two fridge and the other says it's number one fridge, and that hurts me very badly to have mislabeled fridge.
I don't think
you got a picture of that one.
Oh yes, I do. I've got a number two fridge.
There it is. Look at the label at the top. Right?
Oh yeah, so it's got
number one fridge.
Number one, number two. So crazy people. So I hope you have notified the manager because the temperature's out of range. All right.
I have. Yeah, that's why I had to bring the fridge inside.
Yes, of course, of course.
But I'm the manager, so it's okay.
All right. Now you mentioned at the start in the intro that you said there were some cheeses that you just can't get in Europe, and one of them is Emirati. One of them is
Emirati cheese.
That's the one. So, hang on, I'll just bring a picture up for the viewers. It's this one here. This is the Finnish cheese. And it's in a basket. It's got some eyes, but that's traditional for this cheese.
It should have some gas development, depending on what you've done.
Okay. Now, tell us about this cheese. Now, I had never heard of it until we had a chat. It comes from Georgia. Is that right?
Yeah. So there's a whole range of cheeses which are really similar of this type, right? So the Polish in Poland, you've got your Polish farmer's cheese. And in Bulgaria and in Georgia and all that sort of Eastern Europe, sort of Eastern side of Europe, you get these fresh, lactic, beautifully tangy, meltable cheeses, right? Mm. And this, the Emiratian, just means, so Imeruli, which is the other word you'll have seen for it, is basically Georgian for Emiratian. Right, so it's just in English we'd say it's an Emiratian cheese, and in Georgian you'd say it's an Emiruli cheese, right? So, and basically, Emiratia is a region in Georgia which happens to be famous for cheese, and the Georgians make the most unbelievable food, really, really good, really good, and they're particularly good at cheese, and they make these things called khachapuri, and you've got a picture of those with an egg in the middle.
Ooh.
And this cheese, yeah, you got a picture in there because I'm nuts. I sent it to you.
An egg. Hang on, I'm scrolling through. Yeah. Keep talking. I'll find it.
Bread.
Yes.
Kind of bread sort of thing, you know.
So, I have it. There it is.
There you go. So this is called khachapuri, and basically it's a bread boat in which this Emiratian cheese is crumbled, because it doesn't crumble like a Cheshire, but it crumbles sort of and crumble it up into pieces. You can mill it, basically. And then what you really should do is you should take some of this Imerettian cheese and you put it through a pasta filata process. Mm. And it's then called sulguni, which is basically exactly the same cheese, but it's been pasta filata treated. So you've got all the protein strands aligned.
Stretched.
You combine these two together, you basically get what some people call Georgian pizza. So it's bread with the cheese on top. Then you bake it for a while. Then you put a ladle and you put a little dip in it and you put a raw egg in and you put it back in the oven. And then you pull it out of the oven and use the bread to dip in the cheese and you mix the egg up and you've got a kind of eggy, you know, baked, eggy, cheesy, dribbly, stringy thing. And it's absolutely
sounds amazing and delicious.
Really amazing. And not difficult so long as you've got the cheese.
Mm. Yeah, of so course.
Go on.
No. And like you said, you can't get it in the UK.
You can't really get it anywhere except in the countries it's made.
Yeah.
It's pretty distinctive. It's a very yogurty, tangy sort of thing. It's not really a UK flavor, you know. Mm. But across the whole of Eastern Europe, you can get it. You know, a lot of the Slavic countries, you can get these types of cheeses. And they're basically really quick. You know, the thing's made in a day. It's ready to eat within about 3 days. Mm. You can brine it. You can dry salt it. Lots of different ways of doing it. You make it in the mountains. You're going to make it with raw milk. I make it with pasteurized. There's a great recipe on New England. And I've had some really good help from people. Well, the one thing I've not been able to get is more bubbles. And I've had a lot of really fantastic conversations with Rachel Wassitz Banks over at Learn to Make Cheese. It's been absolutely fantastic. She's really helped out. She helped out in the Cotton as well.
Yeah.
Sort of thinking through that as well. She's been absolutely amazing. And Tracy Johnson as well. Just helping out a huge amount on that, which is fantastic to really sort of think through the process. And I got some very, very nice help from Ben Dolby at Cheese and Yogurt Making in the UK. Now, he actually went so far as to write off to the manufacturers. The cultures who wrote off to their cheese scientists in the US to say what you probably need to produce more of the bubbles early on is Lückenstock.
Oh, right, yes.
Which I wasn't very familiar with at all, but I happened to have it in some CH19 culture. So I go, okay, I'm going to try some of that. Next make, I'm going to try that. The other thing, which, and this is what I discussed at length with Rachel, is it might be that during the process of making this cheese, there's a point where you bring the temperature up quite high to around 45 degrees. Mm. We think that, according to some of the research that Rachel looked up, is that there's a heat shock effect on the diactylous culture, the LD culture, which may then cause it to produce carbon dioxide early in the process. So maybe we'll get something in those bubbles. So when I next make it, I'm going to bring the temperature up a bit higher during the make and try and see what that does.
Mm.
But it's got a long old sit at quite a high temperature. You keep it at, you know, well into the sort of 20s, early 30s for about 8 hours.
Yeah.
Sitting there, developing this mass of lactic flavors. You can sort of replicate it if you make a you made khachapuri, you can take some feta and you can take some mozzarella, you can mix them together, you get a kind of similar lacticy, salty effect thing. It's not quite the same though. It hasn't got the subtlety of flavor.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to make it. I've got it listed on my schedule of stuff to make next year.
I know you do. Well, I've got a little update on the recipe, which I'll have to give to you.
Shoot it through, and I'll use the bestest recipe you have.
Yeah, well, I'll need to make it. Remind me when you. I think you're planning to make it in January. So if you are, I need to.
Of January. Depends on how hot it gets here. If it's like 900 degrees, I won't be making cheese.
Yeah, 900 degrees, which is pretty tricky to make cheese in.
Yeah, just a little bit. It's like the surface of Venus. It's a little bit hard to make cheese.
Yeah. They're not known for their cheese making.
Those Venusians, there was another cheese picture. Oh, hang on.
Green, that's the problem.
I'll stop it. Next is you got 50,000. Oh, and you got a kefili. Right, hang on. Let's show that.
I took your advice, Kevin, right?
Yes.
And made advice. It. You said, this is a lovely cheese for Christmas. You all want to have this, you know. This is always on my cheese platter.
Definitely.
Taking the mick. And I was like, okay, good. Plus, I can make it in the month I've got left. So that's the picture you've got there is the one of just the other day. And actually, I was going to ask you a question.
Because
I was having a bit of difficulty getting one of the, to be honest, the pressing was a bit wonky. So I went, right, slice a fair bit off, which I was forced to eat, which was terrible.
Of course.
I mean, awful, being forced to eat the cheese that you're making it. But of course, it left, you know, all that nice rind we'd been making by pressing it with some salt.
Yeah, beautiful.
Well, so I tried a few sort of days of salting and you know, and thing. And in the end, you know, I got a fan. And I've got to get this rind dried out. So I wanted to check with you. I basically, it was kind of air. Let's put more air on this side.
Yeah.
Is that something that is a reasonable thing to do?
I've done it before. Yeah. When I've had cheeses that, for whatever reason, don't seem to air dry within 2 or 3 days, which is about the norm at about 21 degrees Celsius. If it's a little bit colder in the kitchen, then it's going to take longer to dry.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Regular turning also helps. But if you've got a fan, hit it with the fan, as in just a desktop fan, you know, the ones.
Yeah, I stuck it about a meter or so away.
Yeah, perfect. Just a bit of air on it, and it'll get rid of the moisture. So once it dries out, then you just keep dry salting, and it's only like 3 weeks. So
well, I mean, it's ready now. It's in the cheese cave now, because it was basically in a slightly warmer room, but still wasn't setting. Now, as you can see, the rind's beautiful.
Oh, it is. So it's fabulous.
Nice, yes, exactly as it should be. Top recipe. Don't know where I got it from. some
bloke on the internet. Yeah.
Yeah, a random bloke on the internet. And his cheese cast. So that's gone in today in a sealed box in the same one as the blue cheeses.
Nice.
Actually, I was going to ask you, is it okay if it's sealed? Because I kind of went, I don't really want this to become a blue Caerphilly, though that might be quite nice.
It won't penetrate into the cheese anyway. If it gets a little bit of, because normally I do keep them in a ripening box, not the same one as other cheeses, but in a ripening box separate to all the others. Sometimes it picks up some mold because of the moisture content of the rind, because it's a very moist cheese, because it's a fairly light pressing. You'll see that once you cut into it, you'll go, holy cheese balls, because the outside is really is thick and solid, and the inside is like a lovely creamy paste. It's just amazing.
You can smell it through the rind. If you, you know, a niff this morning, and it was just, you can smell that, the development of those cultures. You can smell the milk. You know, you're not going to be able to smell that if there's not some liquid in there.
I tell you, it's amazing. When I first made this, it was probably third or fourth cheese I ever made, and I went, I'm hooked on this cheese. And Kim loved it. She just couldn't get enough of it. So that's why I've made it.
You never get to eat it.
I do, because I update the recipes. So as I develop new ones. So the very first one I made with just a plain mesophilic culture, nothing fancy. Yeah, and then I updated it to MAE 4000 series, the farmhouse cheddar series.
I
found that had double the flavor. It was just incredible.
Yeah. Well, I made your latest one, which you've got some MO30 in, which is, I didn't have MO30. But I did have the CH19, which has got some of the Lucanstock in it. So who knows? I might have some gas bubbles in it.
Maybe. It's fairly moist, so it may not, because it won't. The paste may not be elastic enough to hold the bubbles. So if there is some gas production, you may get some swelling. But if it doesn't look like that now, it won't be any problem.
Yeah, it hasn't. No. So, well, there we go. So I'll let you know if CH19 works well for a Caerphilly, you know.
Yeah, for sure. All right, mate. Now, we've still got 25 minutes to go. There's one thing that you haven't alluded to, and this is medieval reenactments. This is because we had a consultation call, about 2 months ago, roughly?
Yeah, it was a while ago, maybe three.
it was so interesting because you wanted to learn how to make a cheese that you could, they may have made in medieval times.
Well, so yeah,
sort of.
Okay, let me unpack this a little. So, I mean, I set you a really. I basically came onto one of the cheese casts, right?
Yeah.
And I said, Gavin, I've got this question. What I need is a cheese that I can make in a day that tastes of something that's got plenty of steps in it, which make it interesting for people to use, which I can actually eat, and which is relatively robust and is not going to kill everybody because it's being made in a historical setting.
Yeah.
And I can't use a temperature gauge. and there's no fridge. So so basically, and you went, I think you need a cheese consultation. I went, yeah, well, I'll have that. And I, by the way, well, such a great, helpful thing for me.
Thanks, Mark.
You were super prepped and you had stuff ready and we went through it and, you know, that was really helpful. But kind of what came out of it was, you know, I made some queso fresco, I made some queso blanco, not enough flavor for me. You know, I made some with lipase and you've got a picture there of a horrific looking cheese. Oh, yeah, that's the other thing. I'm making it in a copper pan.
Yeah.
Which you need to be really careful of, boys and girls, because if you don't have an absolutely 100% guaranteed clean pan, you're going to end up with copper acetate in your cheese, and that's not that great for you. So, particularly with a lactic cheese, like, you know, I end up in the Emirati cheese, it strips all that nice green stuff off the copper. You get a clean pan, but you also get a green cheese.
Yeah.
And you've got a terrible picture of Aziz the cheese, who was basically looked like it was diseased. I've still got it. It's in a double bagged thing in my fridge. It now has the most extreme, it's got like new life forms on it.
And then you're not going to eat it.
No, I'm not, mate. It's all kinds of interesting colors. I just kept it because it's like
science experiment.
It's a science experiment, and we have a lovely lady who comes and helps out with the cleaning each week. And she says to me, "You know, what is this?" And I'm going, "It's an experiment. Can I throw it away?" "No, you can't.
Don't touch my stuff."
Such as ease is an experiment. Anyway, she's always. I made some kombucha once, and I got the scobies,
yeah,
and I dried them out in the oven to
right.
make kind of fruitlet once they'd kind of finished their thing. And they basically looked like puddles of burnt toffee in the middle of the thing. And I was like really enjoying eating them, but I'd left them in the oven. Anyway, I came down and was like, where's me fruit leather? I thought you burnt
stuff and she threw it away, right?
Probably wrong with one of your experiments. So, they're all in the bin. Anyway, so basically the thing with the reenactment is that I started making bread. Right, so the reenactment is basically we're going out, we're there to entertain the public, right? And I'm too old to do the fighting with the swords, and I used to do that. I got scars over my hand from doing that back in the day.
Right.
But so we do this thing called living history, which is really where you're trying to help people be have a connect. For me, this is where you want somebody to have a connection with their history. They want to see what would it have been like for me at this period in history. That for me is what you're connecting. I'm not there to say, here's me showing you something. This is a skills demonstration. This is a human connection thing. And that's how I see it anyway. And one day I decided to make some bread. And I not only decided to make some bread, I decided to make some really, really difficult bread, a massively hydrated bread, right? In a 90% hydration, it's cold. It was probably no more than about 10 degrees that day. And I'm trying to make bread risen. I had to put it underneath a fire.
To make it rise.
Make it rise. Anyway, this bread, and it was massive, like, you know, 18-inch across thing. And basically what happened is some people came over and said, what you doing? And I went, well, I'm making bread, and I'm kneading this thing in a bread trough. And it took me an hour and a half to knead it because it was so cold. And it was so hydrated that it just took this huge amount of time. And there's people going, why is it taking so long? It's really cold, and I'm trying to do something ridiculous and make a kind of French perfectly hydrated dough in the middle of a castle in the middle of Derbyshire. So, and they got hooked. And I had families coming back 6 or 7 times during the day.
Just to find watch out you do what it. Fred,
just to watch, no, to watch Fred the Bread.
Oh, right.
Right?
It's got a name.
Fred, we named him. Named him, right? So Fred the Bread, and they came back to see the rise, and they came back to see the proving, and they came back to see the knocking back, and they came back to see the final proving, and then they came back for this big reveal, and there were 40 people standing around for the reveal of this thing. And by the way, I baked it on a fire in a Dutch oven. So they're going, how can you bake a bread? You haven't got an oven. I say, well, I got this big
pot thing. Yeah, stainless steel castle.
Pot thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, strictly speaking, it wasn't really right for the period, but
don't tell them.
Don't worry about that, right?
Yeah.
No, don't. I've got the correct one for next year.
Oh, right.
And there was just this audible sort of gasp as this, and I was bloody gasping, right? Because this thing was massive. Filled the whole pot. It's 18 inches, about 6 inches tall, and it's perfect. And it's shaped like a sun. And they just were entranced by this. And there was a family there, kids, with kids. And this young lad, he insisted to his mum, he kept coming back. He was about 14. And at the end of the day, he's going, do you know what, mum? I might really enjoy being a baker, because he'd love the science of it, right? Mm. So I was talking about the science without talking about science, because I'm in the medieval period. But yeah, you can talk about, you know, what's going on and the gas inside and the heat and all this. And he'd absolutely loved it. And I used to be a teacher. So for me to see a young person get inspired by something so simple as making your bread was really cool. And so I then thought, well, that worked so well because I was just telling a simple story about a product which we all understand. What else could I do apart from the bread?
Yeah.
And the answer is, cheese.
Of course. It's been around for thousands of years.
Exactly. But we've only got 2 days to make a product, and I need to have something that's ready in a day.
Yeah.
And that's quite hard with cheese. You can make a vinegar cheese, but everybody does that. It's boring, right? There's not much cheese.
And there's not much flavor to it anyway.
Not much flavor and yakety smackety. Maybe make some ricotta. That could be nice. But actually, why don't we see if we can make a rennet cheese in a day? But at the end of the day, you've got a big old cheese, and people go, the Imeretian cheese is my solution to that problem, because it's the Eastern European farmhouse cheese. I'd be very surprised if some style of cheese like that wasn't being made at some point in the UK.
Mm.
Everybody's had yogurt since time immemorial. Everybody's had cultured cheese. They've had buttermilk. Throw it in the milk. Heat the milk up. Throw it in the milk. Wait a bit. Out it comes. Sets. Pull it together. Cheese. Right? Yeah. And then you know, that's close enough for the reenactment thing. You know, it's going to taste good in about 2 days when I've salted it.
Right.
You know, so... And actually, I can feed it to my buddies there. And that's the other thing. A lot of people do these demos and they don't use the product, which I think is wasteful.
Mm.
So for me, it's like, how do I make this product safely? Safely enough that we can eat it ourselves.
Yeah.
Safely enough, a friend who is not going to sue me for poisoning with cheese if I get it wrong. they can eat it. Obviously, the public can't eat it because health and safety and the law. And
sure.
That's quite correct. But for us, it's our choice.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to do, something that we're not wasting, you know? And that Imeretian cheese is already tasty by the end of the day. It's got tang, you know? Mm. It's fresh, but it's tangy, much more flavor than the queso fresco. Because it has that long, long acid set on it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's got a long old sit in the pot, you know, acidifying. And then by a day's time, the next day I've got one brining from the day before, and then I'm making the next one. And then as long as I don't make massive ones, by the end of the weekend, I've actually got probably two or three cheeses, which keeps me going for the next few weeks till the next show.
Definitely. So over the week, so it's on a weekend, right?
It's the 2 days.
So you're making cheese both days?
I try to do the same thing each day because keeps me interested, you know. If you're just sitting there talking to people saying they did this, they did that, they did the other, it's just really dull. And you get bored of it, you don't want to do it. So
you get a different crowd. You get a different crowd every day too, yeah.
Yeah, normally, yeah. Sometimes you get people coming back.
Oh.
You know, we used to have ferrets. We can't take the ferrets anymore because of the insurance. But we used to have the ferrets, and we always had kids coming back to see the ferrets a second day. They love them. We still have ferrets. We just can't take them with us.
Yeah. Yeah. So how often a year do you do the reenactments?
Well, so it rather depends on the year. I mean, back in the day, I was doing 20-odd of them a year.
Oh.
You know, half the year was out every weekend. But I was young and foolish and didn't have anything else more interesting to do, like, I don't know, my study for my degree, you know. Mm. But the these days, I mean, 5 or 6 times. I was out at a not a public event, but an event today with some friends. We had a lovely day just sitting there chatting, making stuff. Somebody was fixing some chainmail, you know, or jacket, put chainmail on. Somebody was making, a cushion. Somebody else was, you know, fixing some bags for a spice box. You know, somebody else was sewing a doublet, you know. So, and we just had a lovely natter. And then we got a wonderful lady called Koff who did an amazing a presentation, a talk about medieval hygiene. and all the various interesting things that happen with that, which I can't say on this channel because
some
of it's quite fruity.
Family friendly, mate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, what's a friend tell you? So if you want to do your old pits in the medieval times, white wine and bilberries.
Nice.
Make that into a solution. Wipe it on your pits. Apparently, works absolutely fantastically as a deodorant.
So that's what you learnt today.
The alcohol and acid, rub it on your pits, but I think white wine, not red, you know?
Right, yes. So. Which may have been difficult to get in the British Isles. White grapes grow all right?
Well, I mean, two things, actually. Number one is we used to be a very famous winemaking nation back in the, actually, that's Roman times. But when you're talking about medieval period, when you're going through the mini ice age, which is when we were very cold.
Yep.
It's huge trade. You know, all these wars that people are having, they're all about money. They're all about trade. You know, certainly among certain classes, they were drinking more almond milk because you're not allowed to eat animal products for more than half the year because of the rules around fasting. So they're actually eating almond milk. Well, where are the almonds coming from? They definitely don't grow in the UK. Well, they're coming up from Spain.
Right.
They're coming up from Italy. You know, there's a trade routes, and these trade routes are coming up, and the wine's coming up from, you know, from France and from Italy and all these places, different types. So there's huge trade and the wine is available, you know, certainly among the upper classes. In the lower classes, they're not going to be drinking wine. They're going to be drinking beer.
Yeah.
Because that's what keeps you healthy. You know, you boil your water to make beer, therefore drink beer. Don't drink water. It's what fish swim in, as they say. You know?
Yes.
So, yeah, not hard to get if you've got the money to buy.
Yeah, but these days there are vineyards in the UK in the southern part,
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, even around Cambridge, there's some quite good vineyards. What we're quite good at, weirdly enough, okay, so that whole bottom of the UK is the same geological strata as Champagne. And because of climate change, you know, we're getting warmer in the UK. And the climate is getting so good that the English sparkling wines, white wines, are winning a lot of awards over in Europe when we stick them in and they're blind tasted.
Yeah.
They're really good now. I mean, they're not cheap. I mean, really, really expensive. You know, but they taste great now if you choose the right wine. And I've even had some great red wine as well.
Yeah.
But it's
I remember when I was because my wife's English, Kim, and she come from Southampton. And whenever we went to the wine shop, or what do they call it? The off license. Sorry, there you go.
It depends. It depends. If you're going for something nice, then you might go to the wine shop. If you're going for a bottle of Plonk, then the off
you go to Tesco's. Yeah. all right. Anyways, so I remember I went in there and I was shocked by the amount of Australian and New Zealand wines. I just couldn't believe it.
Yeah, loads and loads.
And they were so cheap. Yeah. Oh, so cheap. Cheaper than what we get here in Australia.
Well, that's the tax thing, isn't it? I know it's cheap now, but I mean, you know, you guys have got a bit of land out there, you know?
Just a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
And not all of it habitable, though.
No, is it? Well, you know, 900 degrees sun keeps the grapes nice and ripe.
Beautiful.
So, but weirdly enough, it used to be a thing. There's a kind of rebalancing now because a lot of the wines which have been coming out of the New World and Australia, they're very strong. And there's a bit of a sort of rebalance where people are going, do you know, I really don't want to drink a 14% wine.
Yeah,
you
know? Shiraz or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit much, you know. So especially people are much more conscious about their drinking now here. It's become a thing, you know. So those sort of 12%, even 11% sort of French sort of light things, I mean, they're my favorite. I love them. I'm blackcurrant, you know.
Very interesting, mate. Well, not even.
I could go on about that for another hour. I'm not going to because there's also interesting
cheese, bread, wine. We've covered it all, I reckon.
I haven't even covered the beer yet. So,
I used to make beer too. But Emma, we got 10 minutes. All right, let's talk about beer. Do you make your own beer?
I have done in the past, but for me, beer is one of those things. It's like I don't make cheddar,
right?
Because I can buy fantastic cheddar at the Cambridge Cheese Shop.
Yeah.
Amazing cheese shop.
Real cheddar.
Oh, man. Yeah. Lincolnshire Poacher, all that stuff. You know, to be honest, making Stilton, there's so many good Stilton makers. And I can buy good Stilton. You know, I bought a baby Stilton, you know, the other day for Christmas, £40, delivered. that's pretty good value.
Yeah, so that's the opposite for me because I can't get any of those cheeses here. Well, no, we can, but they've been transported so long, even if it's by air freight, they've been sitting in the cheese shop for God knows how long. So it's.
I think this is, I think this is why in America and in Australia you've actually got this wonderful cheese making culture because you Paul Todd's can't get the good cheeses.
Yeah, for we're going to make our own. We're going to copy and make our own.
Yeah. So look up. There's a wonderful producer, food producer called Claudia Romero. Look her up on YouTube. She worked for Food Insider, Business Insider, for a long time.
Oh yes, I've seen Claudia. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she's amazing. I love her.
And she speaks so many languages too.
Oh, she's astonishing. She's so clever. And the way she gets into, and you can see she loves the food. Yeah. So she made a thing on Stitchleton the other day, which Stitchleton is the original name of the village of Stilton, which is where the cheese was made in Melton Mowbray was sold on the big road, A1, which is the old Roman road, goes up the UK. All this cheese used to come onto that big road and be sold in the village of Stilton in Lincolnshire. That's why it's called Stilton. It wasn't made there, but it was sold there. There's a really interesting American guy who came over, and he's now making a raw milk Stilton. But he can't call it Stilton because during the 1980s, when they did the PDO designation, they made a mistake, and they basically said, Stilton has to be pasteurized cheese. And now they've got a rod on their own back. So
you can't buy raw milk Stilton.
You can't buy raw milk Stilton doesn't exist because PDO designation says it's a pasteurized milk. So he's making this wonderful cheese called Stitchleton, and it's good. I've had a bit. It's not cheap, but oh man.
Yeah.
You know. Now that I think would be worth making. But the other cheeses which I like to make, the ones which, as I said, you can't get. It's the same with beer.
Yeah.
I can make beer. I'm in Cambridge. We have a lot of pubs. There used to be over 300 pubs, 365 pubs, something like that. You know, we're down a bit now. We've still got like 300 and something.
We've got three in our town.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's 150,000 people in Cambridge. We need a lot of pubs. You know?
Yeah.
There's microbrewers. I got a buddy who runs a brewery called Milton Brewery. He makes the most fantastic beer. There's a Cambridge brewery. There's another buddy of mine who's we call Simon the Cider. He runs the Cambridge Cider Company. He makes the most amazing cider. He's got a really interesting guy. He goes around collecting apples from people's trees.
Oh, right.
From anywhere they can get it, bruised, broken, off cast, whatever it is, and he makes cider out of them. Really interesting guy. Makes great cider. So those things we can get them, you know. And if you don't, I don't drink a huge amount of beer. So I don't need to sort of make enough to make it cheap because it's not cheap. But we can get a lot of good beer here, and we can get all styles. You know, we can get continental style, we can get Australian style, we can get American style. Get IPAs coming out your ears. You know, there's a thing, IPA. You know why it's called IPA?
Indian Pale Ale, made in India. You know,
no, it's not. It was made to go to India, which is why it's so hoppy. Because you put the hops in so the beer can go all the way from UK over to India
and via still ship. Be good
via ship and still be good when it gets there, and then everybody's got the taste for it.
There you go.
Got the antiseptic quality of the hops in it. Love it. Love an IPA. I like making drinks, but I prefer making vinegar, weirdly.
Yeah.
Good vinegar is hard to get.
It is. There are, well, because it's mostly mass manufactured these days, and rarely can you find artisan vinegar makers, if that makes sense, using SCOBY and everything. So
that's it. But you know, it's super, so simple. I've had one on the go about 3 years now, and literally, so I love wine. I know one of the questions you were going to ask was about what's my favorite drink with cheese.
Yeah,
that'll be wine, right?
I didn't get to it, but yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I know, but you know. you forewarned me to think about it, so I'm telling you. We've only got 5 minutes left, so I'll tell you. So, but the wine's great, but the trouble is, I don't drink enough. I open a bottle, but I only drink half of it. My wife doesn't really drink, and then I'm like, well, I don't want to throw this away. So what I do is I got some vinegar, like live vinegar, and I stuck half a bottle of wine, and I threw this, the live vinegar sort of mulch, whatever it's called, the mother in there, and left it alone. And then I came back to it about a month or two later, and it's turned into the most fantastic vinegar.
Yeah.
And then so I just add any wine I get.
Just keep adding it to it. So if you got like a demijohn with the mother in it.
Yeah, I've got a glass jar and it's got a tap on the bottom.
Right.
And it stacks up the mothers, and occasionally I take them out and try to keep them a little bit fresh. And I just pour it in. And the only time it went wrong was when a friend of mine sent me a bottle of port once, which was a bit
too strong for it.
No, mate. Oh, I love port, but it's
too strong for the vinegar, I mean.
Well, she'd done something like put some herbs in it or something.
Right.
And it tasted terrible. And I thought I'd lost my vinegar. 3 years making it. I just left it enough time, it came back. So it's now tastes great again. But this thing's got all kinds of crazy stuff in it. It's got bottles of 1960s wine, 1980s, 1970s. My dad, when he died, he left a whole bunch of wine, which isn't really drinkable because it's far too old. But you have a little sip just to see what it would have been once, and then you put it in the vinegar thing.
Right.
You get all the flavor, but it's already kind of turning towards vinegar anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, I've got this unbelievable vinegar.
Magnificent.
It's really nice. It's really nice. So.
Well done, mate.
Yeah,
well, fun. I could, we could talk forever just about.
You could.
Yeah. So finally, I actually got one question from the list of questions I sent you.
Yeah.
So what are your words of encouragement for new cheesemakers?
I think firstly, don't sweat it. If it goes wrong, it goes wrong. And practice on cheap milk. You know, don't be buying really expensive raw milk to start with or something. Just get something and practice, and don't sweat it. People get really worried about it. Use your senses, use your smell, and your channel's been amazing. Learn to Make Cheese, amazing Facebook resource.
Yeah, it Jennifer is great.
Jennifer Merch on YouTube. I don't know if Jennifer's watching. Jennifer, I love your videos so much. She's fabulous, especially when her teenager's being irritating. She gives them a lot. absolutely love her. But she doesn't sweat it. She gets on with it, you know? And I think, but the other thing is, don't sweat the end result, but do sweat the process.
Yeah.
Follow the process carefully, because it's just rennet, milk, salt, cultures. But when and the temperatures and how long matter, because that's all there is to it. And yet
that's all the science to it.
But that's, you've got thousands of cheeses, but you've only got four ingredients. So seriously, there must be, the process is important. So I think that's the sort of key thing, really. But if you make it a pasteurized milk, your chances of doing something horrible to yourself are much better. I love raw milk, but for a home cheesemaker to start with, you know, I've made one or two raw milk, but to be honest, it was just like, you know, I'm just going to concentrate on pasteurized for now because I want to absolutely nail that process. So then when I start making raw milk cheese, I've already got proper learning under my belt.
And you've got the proper sanitization and hygiene as well.
Yeah, I just make it in my kitchen. I'm super religious about, spray my phone. You know, spray my hand, everything gets super sanitized religiously, ultra careful about it, because I don't want to waste money, so I'd rather be super, you know, stink of vinegar all night, you know. So what,
me too,
you know.
Yep.
So that for me is super hygiene, as far as you can, and follow the process, and if it goes wrong, stick it in the fridge, call it Aziz. Stick it in a bag
and call it an experiment.
Lady, throw it out. Yeah, call it like an interesting experiment.
Mate, great advice. Thank you so much. And Dan, thank you so much for the chat, mate. I've been reading the comments as they've been coming in, and they can't believe that after 50 minutes, you're still a very interesting guest. So well done, mate.
Oh, that's lucky.
No drama at all.
That's right, dabbing with faint praise, that is. Thanks, buddy.
Good on you. Thank you so much. I'll see you we'll chat again soon.
Yeah, speak soon, bud.
All right. Cheers, mate.
Bye.
So I dare say you can agree with me that Dan was an amazing guest on the podcast. Thank you, Dan, for that amazing interview. And don't forget that if you want to check out our live streams, you can pop over to YouTube channel Gavin Weber, and you can see live streams as well as all of the YouTube cheese making tutorials that I make on a weekly basis. You've been listening to the Little Green Cheese Podcast. If you want to pick up my two books, Keep Calm and Make Cheese and Keep Calm and Make More Cheese, you can get them in the link in the description of the podcast or the video. I also have a course. You can pick that up at courses.littlegreenworkshops.com.au. I have a beginner's cheese making course and a blue cheese making course. Well, that's all from me this week. Thanks for listening and watching, and I will see you next time.